From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We'll imagine other worlds today. The organizers of a con called The State of Black Science Fiction will join us to talk about Afrofuturism and steampunk.
You better wake up. The world you live in is just a sugar-coated topic. There is another world beneath it. The real world.
Then we'll visit the world under the sea with a deep dive into the oyster industry here in Georgia. Plus, we'll learn about the best ways to eat and prepare oysters. That's coming up. First, though, let's revisit a conversation from yesterday about plutonium. We broke down what the chemical element is and whether or not it's dangerous. It is. Nikolaos Kidanakis is a professor of physics at Kennesaw State University.
And the reason why it's hard to find plutonium on Earth is that its half-life is relatively short, so most of it has decayed away during the Earth's life. And the way to produce it is through nuclear reactions. So it is, I think, quite amazing that we can actually recreate conditions at the center of stars, or even seconds, fractions of a second after the Big Bang, the beginning of the universe.
So here are your first thoughts. Black physicist tweets, Georgia's coal-fired plants belch out a lot more radioactive material than SRS does, I'm sure. She was referring to the Savannah River site, which is where they store a lot of plutonium on the Georgia coast. Ultra Verified writes, plutonium, when inhaled, is one of the most carcinogenic things humans can be exposed to. It's the worst of fission byproducts. We always love to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. And remember, we might feature your comment on the show. Construction workers in Augusta, Georgia, made a frightening discovery in the summer of 1989. 10,000 bones buried in a basement under the dirt of a 150-year-old building. And the bones told a story. Markings revealed they came from dissected bodies. The building that kept their secret for so long was the former home of the Medical College of Georgia. How the bones got there is a little-known chapter in Augusta's history, and here to tell us more is David Adams. He's the coordinator of the Anatomical Donation Services at Augusta University. Hi there, David. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And also with us is Nick Garrett. He's a communications coordinator at Augusta University. Hi, Nick. Thanks to you as well.
Good morning.
So the bones that they discovered in 1989, do we have solid records on all of them, David?
To my knowledge, we do not.
And why is that?
Well, these dissections occurred in the 1800s before the records were kept.
And how does this connect with the story of Grandison Harris, which is a story that I guess is sort of apocryphal in Augusta? It's one that's told here and there?
Correct. Grandison was known as a resurrection man. And during the 1800s, when he was with the Medical College of Georgia, he, of course, came as a slave and was taught the trade of the art of resurrection, which was actually going to the cemeteries and bringing these fresh bodies back to the medical college for dissection.
And this was he was working for the college. He wasn't a freelancer.
That's correct.
Okay, so and do we have any idea if all of the bodies that were discovered there were collected by Grandison Harris?
I don't know that all of them were just necessarily bodies. I have an idea that some of these bones that they actually found probably were left over from the actual Civil War, because at that time the Medical College of Georgia was being used as an Army Corps hospital. And I'm sure a lot of these were soldiers who were wounded, lost limbs, and that type thing.
So, Nick, this has become, you described it as a bit of a folk legend on students. How does that happen?
I think a lot of it is incoming medical students hear from faculty and other students who've been at the college for a little while about the story of Grandison Harris. They hear it in the community. They hear it from parents who've lived in town. And it has, as you said, become a bit of a folk legend because it's so often treated as one, but the reality is that this was someone who actually strove to advance medical science and the study of anatomy.
And, okay, he was actually purchased as a slave by the medical college in 1852. Is that accurate?
Correct.
You were about to say
something? Actually, it was 1834.
Oh, okay. So he was a slave until the Civil War freed him, but he continued to work for the college, and he actually lived until the age of 95. Nick, can you tell me a little bit about that last I guess this comes from a former dean of the school about his last job?
There's actually, for a while, there's been a legend that he came back for one last lecture before he officially retired. Supposedly, that lecture was about the finer points of resurrecting, as David said, of finding fresh bodies and bringing them in and treating them for anatomical dissection.
And students got, he abandoned his cart because students came and spoke to him. That's the story.
Oh,
anyway.
I'm sorry. That was a separate story.
There's too many stories to keep track of.
Right, absolutely. Supposedly, he stopped by a bar one night after visiting the cemetery, stepped in for a drink, and while he was there, two students happened to see him. They came out, climbed into the back of the cart, and climbed into an empty sack. And when he came back to retrieve the cart, they pretended to be bodies and spoke to him. And it scared him so badly that he supposedly abandoned the cart that night and just ran screaming.
But we don't have any idea if any of these things are true, right? I mean, right, we don't have any record of Grandison himself recording his life and work.
Right, not to my knowledge.
So tell me a little bit, David, about resurrection, because this is not just what happened in Augusta. This was a whole era in
it
medical
was worldwide.
History. Yeah.
Right. It started in Edinburgh, Scotland with Burke and Hare. And this was late 1700s. Burke and Hare, and I'm not sure which one owned a boarding house, but one of the patrons died, and so they had to do something with the person. They had no money to bury him, so what they did, they took the actual body to an anatomist there in Edinburgh, and he paid them a few shillings. So they found out, hey, this is easy money. The part of it was they started killing some of their subjects and taking them and getting paid, and then they were caught and later executed and dissected. But this started the resurrection.
And, I mean, it led to all kinds of things. I mean, not every
right.
resurrectionist was a murderer.
Oh, no. Just these two.
Yeah.
But basically, the need for bodies or subjects got to be a very prevalent need with the medical schools all growing and becoming of age, so to speak. And so they were having to do what they could to find these subjects. Augusta was only about 7,000 population at the time that Grandison started his reign in Augusta, so to speak. So it was a small community. Larger communities like New York, they were having to go to New York and buy bodies and bring them back, or Baltimore, somewhere like that, and have them shipped in for dissection until Grandison came along. And Grandison was actually taught how to read and write. He became a very educated man, but he knew how to go about finding these fresh graves.
Basically,
they said that he could go in and take a grave apart and put it back together, and nobody ever knew that he had been there.
Nick, was this legal?
Absolutely not. Not at the time. at the time, medical dissection in Georgia was illegal. The one exception, to my understanding, was executed criminals could be used for medical dissections.
Right, although those were very difficult to come by. My guests are Nick Garrett, communications coordinator at Augusta University, and David Adams, coordinator of the Anatomical Donation Services at Augusta. Here's a comment from Sylvia Smith, who's chair of the Department of Cellular Biology and Anatomy at the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta. And she's talking about a memorial service that medical students now hold for their cadavers.
They talk about the value for their own educational experience. Many of them give their other gifts, gifts of music or poetry, because they are so grateful for the opportunity to dissect. And I think it's important that family members know that we do this and that things have really truly changed over the last several centuries.
Nick, what do the stories of Grandison and grave robbing tell medical students today? How has the attitude changed since then?
Well, the attitude today is, in some ways, it's similar. It's the advancement of medical science is of the utmost importance. The difference is today there's a much greater emphasis placed on treating remains respectfully. There's a much greater emphasis on the teacher-student relationship, I guess you could say, between students and the cadavers they work with.
And the other thing, David, is that oftentimes grave robbers, they were relatively common around the world, but they were also seen kind of like the executioner. The attitude towards the public, towards people who are known to supply cadavers, was that they were kind of off limits.
Correct.
Was that the attitude also towards Grandison?
Oh, sure. People would, from what I understand, when they would encounter him on the streets, they would actually cross over. And it didn't matter, you know, who they were. They wanted to steer clear of him.
And we have records now at Augusta. Nick, you wrote the piece on Grandison. And what kind of records does Augusta keep? And how do they remember Grandison Harris?
Well, that's the thing about Grandison. The records that we have on Grandison are spotty at best. And I feel like that's uniform in the entire community. That's what's helped him become sort of a folk legend, is that we don't remember him as well as, you know, we would today, obviously.
Do you think we should, though? Do you think that the college should remember him better or commemorate him?
Well, the college has actually commemorated him. They're actually on the premises. There is a plaque dedicated to Grandison Harris and the work that he has done. As for whether the community and the college should remember him better, I say that we remember him fondly for what he did. I don't think that his memory has been disrespected so much. But I think it's important to remind people that the work he did was absolutely crucial to medical study in the 1800s.
And as David suggested, he kind of paid a price for that. David, have we ever remembered the work of Grandison Harris as well as you think we should?
Well, I think we have done what's appropriate because of the fact that we don't know a lot about him, other than what few records Nick said that we have that are very spotty. I do actually, in my office, have a charcoal portrait of Grandison that hangs in my office that Dr. Steve Harrison did for me.
That is David Adams. He's the coordinator of the Anatomical Donation Services at Augusta University. Nick Garrett is communications coordinator at Augusta. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. When it comes to comic books, cosplay, animation, and all things nerdy, Atlanta is the greatest place possibly to be. Thousands of curious tourists were just here for the 11th annual MomoCon just a few days ago, and attendance at last year's DragonCon broke records with more than 70,000 people. Now another homegrown convention hopes to draw crowds this weekend. The State of Black Science Fiction Convention wants to bring more attention to sci-fi subgenres like Afrofuturism and steampunk. We have two co-founders of that convention with us now. They are Balogun Ojitade and Milton Davis. Hello to both of you.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Yatasha Womack is with us as well by Skype. She's the author of the book Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture. Good morning, Yatasha.
Good morning.
Since you wrote the book quite literally, Yatasha, can you explain what Afrofuturism is? And I ask this knowing that it appears that there's some disagreement sometimes on the definition.
Well, Not entirely. I'll say that Afrofuturism is a way of looking at the future and alternate realities through a Black cultural lens. It's an intersection between Black culture, the imagination, liberation, technology, and mysticism. And you see it in the arts, but it's also a tool of self-healing and can be the basis of critical race theory.
So Balogun, if we look at, if Afrofuturism really started to develop in the 90s, mm-hmm. how come we harken back to like the music of Sun Ra from much earlier and say that's also part of Afrofuturism? How do we connect those?
Because it fits the tropes of Afrofuturism that Yatasa just described. Would Sun Ra have described himself as an Afrofuturist? Probably not. But if he was here today, probably so. I didn't call my work Afrofuturism. I called it Black Speculative Fiction. But I've been described as an Afrofuturist, that I write Afrofuturism. And I have accepted the term because it's the going term that the mainstream has accepted, you know, for it. I do meet the tropes that were just defined. Originally, there wasn't a strong definition for it. So I couldn't call myself something without a strong definition. But in recent times, thanks to Yatasha, thanks to the artist John Jennings and others, it has been strongly defined.
So what, Yatasha, do we include in Afrofuturist works? For example, if you have something like the modern-day Doctor Who includes Black characters, does that make it part of Afrofuturism? Or does it have to be the kind of science fiction that deals with the cultural and societal problems that Africans and Black people face today?
Well, it's more or less about looking at the problems. It's really about referencing Black culture. Or Black cultures around the world, pulling from that. I think using the imagination to transcend your circumstance is a key point as well. But it also just looks at the actual construction of a thing, you know, looking at the kinds of technologies that are used, say, even in music, which a lot of Black jazz artists and funk pioneers kind of pioneered in many ways, and kind of harks back to some of the futurist theories around how music of the future would sound. So, I mean, it embraces a wide array of concepts. But I do think that the looking at the technology and looking at how it can be used to alleviate a lot of isms is a big key standpoint.
I want to play you, Balogun, this comment from artist Ted Fielder. He's talking about the disconnect he felt. And this is something that many Afrofuturists talk about, watching things like Logan's Run or the original Doctor Who and seeing that the future in that world only included white people. So here's his comment on that when he started reading comic books.
The people in those comics really don't look like you. You know, they look like the big white guy with the muscles and, you know, he flew away. That's what happened. We wanted to be the one that would fly off the roof with the expanding cape, right? We wanted to be the ones who would be able to show we're the Dark Knight. We wanted to have that opportunity, too.
You have said that people are surprised when you tell them that you're a science fiction writer. Why do you think that is?
Yes, because historically, we did not read science fiction. And when I say we, I'm talking about Black people. But at several conventions and several events that I throw, I ask people who aren't normally into science fiction and fantasy, do you watch science fiction movies? I'll say, you know, who here has watched The Matrix? All the hands go up.
Yeah.
Who here has watched The Hunger Games? All the hands go up. Then I say, who here has read The Matrix? Not The Matrix, The Hunger Games. And not many hands go up. If you don't see yourself or you don't think you're going to see yourself in writing because you're going to spend much more time, you'll spend an hour and a half, maybe 3 hours at the most with science fiction and fantasy in a film, 30 minutes to an hour on television.
Yeah.
But with a book, you're spending days to weeks to months on that book. You're not going to spend that amount of time if you don't see yourself or anyone relatable to you.
Let me go to you, Melton, because speaking of the Hungry Apes, when I read those books, she's described, the lead character, Katniss, is described as having olive skin. I honestly thought it was a woman of color that they were describing. I wonder, Milton, if you think that's seeing some of the remakes of old classics, seeing Star Trek with more people of color in it, or black characters appearing in, like, Doctor Who, does this mean that Afrofuturism, at least in that way, is making a difference?
Yeah, I believe what we're doing has made a difference. I started this journey back in 2005 when I started writing, and I think that was kind of a critical point in what we see now as black speculative fiction. A lot of the people that I know that are in the industry right now that are starting to make strides, we were all kind of like percolating under the surface during that time. And now it seems like what we're doing is starting to come to the forefront because of critical mass, and I believe it's having a direct effect on what we're seeing now with things like Star Trek and with some of the other areas, some of the other things going on. As far as being incorporated, I still think that the incorporation is not complete because we're seeing it's good to see people who are appearing in these shows that happen to be black, but we're still pretty good away from having situations where the characters have to be black. We're actually seeing our culture being incorporated into the stories and telling stories that that we can connect to, and I think that's starting to happen. It's been happening on the independent side for a long time, but we're starting to see that emerge into the mainstream representation.
If you're just joining us, my guests are black science fiction convention organizers. You just heard Milton Davis, also with us is Balogun Ojitade, and we have author Yatasha Womack. We're talking about Afrofuturism and the black science fiction convention coming to Atlanta this weekend. Yatasha, let me play you this comment from Masi Mbawe, Mbewa from the University of Namibia. She's talking about what her goal is for black science fiction.
At the end of the day, my dream is to walk into a bookstore and have Afrofuturist novels written by beautiful African writers on the shelves. I want to not be able to get away from it. I want it to overwhelm me. I want Afrofuturism to take over the world and become a movement.
So what is your goal, Yatasha? Is it for Afrofuturism to become a movement, or is it something else?
Well, for me, it's just about people feeling that they can create stories and reference their culture, if they're people of African descent or people of any background, feeling as if they can tell those stories, feeling as if they can use their imagination to push past any sense of limitation, and feeling like they have a sense of agency so that they can create their own lives and contribute to conversations about the future. That's really what I'm interested in.
Milton, why not turn it into a non-white science fiction convention? I mean, certainly there's not a lot of Latinos also in Logan's Run or the original Star Trek. Why not open it up?
Well, the State of Black Science Fiction started as a collective of writers, and mainly what we were trying to do is create opportunities and open up a dialogue for us to reach readers and stuff. And that's what we've been basically focused on. I'm all for everybody, creating the same thing that we did and make a market to where they can actually reach the readers. But we've really emphasized the part of it being black science fiction because in the past, being black, that's where we've seen a lot of the gatekeepers prevent us from telling the stories that we want to tell. I think there's opportunity for conventions, and I think there have been conventions that will be conventions that are focusing on just people in color in general. But I think it's important that we have it the way it is right now because that's basically the audience that we're focusing on, and those are the creators that we're trying to expose.
Balogun, there has been a documented discrimination against writers of color, and it's especially bad in science fiction. That's not my opinion. That's been established through some pretty good, solid research. Is that have we made progress in that, should I say? Or is it getting any better for writers like yourself? I mean, among the main publishing world.
Among mainstream publishing, yes, because of independent publishers. Thank goodness that, and I don't want to name the companies, but thank goodness now we're able to publish our own work. because, as Milton mentioned, the gatekeepers for a long time, they did not allow us to present characters. And even, I'm in an anthology, a steampunk anthology, that I was asked to be in the second edition. I refused because every black character in it, and this is supposed to be a multicultural steampunk anthology, every black character, they drew each person's character, every black character, they either have their back turned or it's drawn from an angle where you can't see the face clearly. And I sent the pictures to Milton. I said, you know, we still have a lot of work to do. So, and that was a independent book, but highly, highly, highly supported through crowdfunding.
Yeah.
And they could never get me to write again.
Yatasha, what's, if I have just, I'm just hearing of Afrofuturism for the first time, what's the first movie or book you send me to for my best introduction?
My book, Afrofuturism, the world of black sci-fi and fantasy culture. And I'm saying that really because I wrote it to, as a primer, to help introduce people to the concepts, and so that they can see how they, how their philosophies or their fandom, you know, intersects, and they can see themselves in the book.
And what about you, Milton? Would you, I mean, my son would immediately say Afro Samurai, but what would you send people to?
There's so many books that I think. I mean, I think the first book I would probably recommend, just from a historical perspective, would be Dark Matter, the anthology that Sheree Renee Thomas released back in the 90s, because it was the first book that came out that basically gathered people who were black writers in speculative fiction and put them in the forefront. And so I think that would probably be the first one I would recommend from a historical perspective. From a current perspective, I would say the anthology that Balogun and I produced, Steampunk, because steampunk was basically our answer to the lack of black writers in the steampunk genre. The people in steampunk basically felt as though they had a genre that was open to everyone. But you weren't seeing that in the people attending the cons and in the books that you were reading.
Right. So, it's a very steampunk has been relatively white. You've just heard Milton Davis, an author and co-chair of the upcoming convention. Balogun Ojitade is co-chair of the State of Black Science Fiction Convention. And Yatasha Womack, author of the book Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, also director of the film Bar Star City. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you so much having us.
The convention is Saturday and Sunday, June 11th and 12th at the Fulton County Southwest Arts Center. For more information, visit gpbnews.org.
Greetings, Earthling.
Has a television show ever had a profound impact on you? One man in Georgia, a young man, had a transformative experience at a recent screening of the History Channel miniseries Roots. Jason Crichton of Atlanta is 15 years old. He attends Therrell High School, and he says the show has encouraged him to take a stand against the casual use of a word that has the potential to offend. And he says that word a couple times in this commentary. So listeners, please be advised.
It's time your family pay for all the trouble they have caused me, Kunta. Come peacefully. The ransom negotiations should not take long. Then you can go free.
Go free. I am free.
A thought ran through my mind as I watched a screening of the miniseries Roots recently. This is the best damn movie I've ever seen. As a black teen growing up in East Point, I am ashamed of how my peers disrespect our culture by not taking advantage of the opportunities that were paid for by the murder and rape of our ancestors. And, like most of my peers and friends, I accepted when others dropped the N-word. I never gave it much thought until I saw those white slave traders show up on screen spewing the word nigger all over the place. It was a reminder of how much hate the word originally carried.
We spoke at length, no more purchases for a while, and look what you did. Brother, I do not like holding so much of your debt.
What on earth are you talking about? I'm going to get 30 years good service out of him. And have money in my pocket from selling the niggers that he's replacing.
I feel bad that my friends today use it in a flattering way as if it was created to empower black people and express pride. Roots enhanced my understanding the way vibrato on a violin enhances a song.
You understand me, Toby?
Cuenta gente.
No, listen to me. Master's wife done named you Toby.
Cuenta gente. Pamoro moro gente. Dinka paluti.
I ain't got time to chitwag with it.
You feel Cuenta gente's anger during his fight scenes. His eyes flash bloodshot, and his dark brown skin turns dull like burnished mahogany. My struggles are different, lightened by the load he and countless slaves carried before my birth. But I still feel his anger. Before watching this Roots remake, I didn't value the history of African Americans the way I do now. Roots did more for me than any school lecture or textbook ever will. I feel educated and inspired to do something. But one thing I won't accept is the use of the N-word. From now on, when others say it, I'll remind them of the true meaning of nigger.
Jason Crichton is a student at Therrell High School in Atlanta. He wrote a version of that commentary for Vox Teen Communications. That's a teen magazine in Atlanta. Be sure to join us tomorrow for a deeper look at the remake of Roots. And you can join the conversation with your thoughts if you've seen it. Call us at 404-500-9457 or reach us on Facebook. Well, you can serve them fried, steamed, or on the half shell, but oysters probably don't immediately come to mind as a food product of Georgia. However, there is an oyster renaissance underway in the South, so we're told, and the mollusk will be the subject of a class at this weekend's Southern Grown Festival on Sea Island. Chef Mike Lotta will demonstrate the many ways to prepare oysters. He's the owner of Fig and the Ordinary in Charleston, South Carolina, and he joins me now via Skype. Hi there, Mike.
How are we doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Can you tell me if there's a marked difference between the oyster of South Carolina and the oyster of Georgia?
Well, you know, the best way to describe to a lot of people how different oysters can be, you know, when we look at wine varietals, you know, and I always kind of pick Chardonnay as my example, you know, be it grown in, well, first of all, in Burgundy, you know, every different lot or plot of grapes is going to like have some kind of a different attribute. And, you know, that's called terroir. Terroir. The oyster version of that is called merroir. So what that really means, if that term is not familiar to you or the listeners, that say an oyster, all the oysters on the East Coast, with the exception of a Ballon oyster, are the same variety. And if the oyster lives in the mouth of a river and the brackish water is kind of the environment of which it lives, well, then the oyster is not going to be that salty compared to an oyster that might be raised on the open ocean, say like in an area where there's no brackish water or the tidal creeks, like really just kind of ebb and flow that salty water from the ocean. They're going to taste totally different. So up and down the coast of Georgia and South Carolina, you've got all kinds of estuaries and different kind of geographic kind of influences that can make the oyster taste different from one another. Now, most East Coast oysters tend to be on the saltier side, which is what I like. And it seems that a lot of connoisseurs also feel the same way. So a lot of times it's different levels of salinity we're talking about, but generally speaking, they're most often going to be more salty than not.
Okay, let's bring Brian Rackley into this discussion. He's one of the many people that wants Georgia to become a bigger player in the oyster game. Brian is co-owner of the Kimball House in Atlanta and part of a group that works to advance coastal aquaculture of oysters in the South. Welcome, Brian.
Good morning.
So you have had, you love oysters. That's fair?
Yeah, I would say I do.
And you've had oysters from all over the place.
I've had oysters from all over the place.
So what makes Georgia's oysters good oysters?
Well, I mean, Georgia's oyster scene is still one that's so young. I mean, it's burgeoning. And I think what's going to make it good is what makes anybody's oysters good is that, you know, the people that are actually doing the farming, they care a lot about the product that they're offering us because they know that if they want to continue to have great relationships and great sales, they're going to have to work with restaurants. They're going to have to sell oysters to us. So, you know, they want their stuff to be good. So it really is just a matter of does the farmer care enough about the environment and where they're growing their oysters and the way they're bringing up their oysters, because that's what's going to translate to success for them.
And you use the word farmer. And in fact, from what I looked up in the statistics, Americans eat about 2.5 billion oysters per year. Most of those are farm raised. Mm-hmm. Are we hoping to have farm raised oysters here in Georgia?
Well, we have to have farm-raised oysters here in Georgia, and I think that's what's going to make us a player in this game that we're talking about, because Georgia's oyster population, much like the one off the coast of Charleston where Mike lives, is it's wild, and the wild oysters tend to grow in clusters. The clusters are great for backyard cookouts. They're great for grilling.
But clusters, they attach to each other.
Yeah. So it's wild oyster spat as opposed to farm spat. So they grow up in these like clusters. And so if you have like 9 or 10 or 12 oysters that are growing together, you have to literally break them apart to make them raw bar ready. So what we're doing at Kimball House,
and we know that Americans are pretty lazy, and we don't want to do that extra work.
Yeah, it's not that it's extra work. It's just a totally different culture. So the roasting culture versus the raw bar culture are it's a different atmosphere. It's just a different thing. And I love eating cooked oysters, and I love eating them over a fire. It's great. But for what we're doing at our restaurant, and you know the future of raw bar culture here in Georgia in the Southeast, you know, we need stuff that's easy to get into. It's comes to us. It's clean. It's consistent. It's ready to open, and we can serve it on ice, basically with not a lot of fuss.
Mike, is there an authentic way to eat an oyster?
Well, my preference is totally naked. Like I
the half shell, raw, right. Slide it down your throat.
Yeah, there was no half shell, you know, speaking to the same subject about the clusters, there was no half shell culture here in Charleston up until recently because of the clustered oysters. So, you know, the way that traditionally the oysters were eaten were at the oyster roasts. And so there is definitely a traditionalist perspective there on if you're going to eat an oyster in Charleston, that is the way to do it. But to really gain a great sense of place when you eat the oyster, raw is going to give you the real read on what the environment was like where the oyster was raised.
Now, Georgia, Brian, has just launched its first oyster hatchery. Tell me about that. How many oysters can that hatchery handle?
The last I heard...
it's on Skidaway Island.
Skidaway, and it's the UGA Marine Extension Service. It's operated by Tom Bliss and Justin Manley. Those guys they know what they're doing. The last I talked to them, they were I think thinking that they could get maybe around 10 million seed in the next year. And you know, it'll require that for us to begin to see some productivity out of these burgeoning farms off the coast of Georgia.
And when they when we're talking about an oyster hatchery, are we just talking about a big pool?
Not entirely. There's a lot of different compartments to a hatchery. Because you've got different types of algae you're planning on feeding your seed. You've got tanks where you're actually collecting. You've got your males and your females that are sending sperm and eggs together into separate tanks. You might be trying to raise diploids and triploids, which are
triploids
chromosomally
don't
different.
Reproduce.
They don't reproduce, which is there's
supposedly better because they focus all their energy on getting big and delicious.
They do, and there's pros and cons to both, I'm sure. But in the South where waters are warmer and oysters tend to spawn more often, a triploid's kind of a neat thing to be able to have access to.
Mike, why are we seeing sort of a renaissance in oysters here in the South? Is that manufactured by people like yourself and Brian, or is there another reason for it?
Well, yeah, in some ways it is. But, if you want to work on the water, there's not that many options anymore that seem viable. Number two, the demand has been, steadily increasing over the last couple of years. And lastly, it's actually really kind of not a hard thing to get into because the leases are cheap. You can start by working with wild oysters. So just
getting in a boat and grabbing them?
Exactly. And you can chisel the clusters down. You can kind of manipulate them to where you can actually, you know, be selling oysters almost immediately after getting the lease. You know, and I think in many ways, it's one of the biggest net win businesses that we deal with in the restaurant industry right now, because, you know, primarily because, you know, it's difficult to be a farmer. It's difficult to be a fisherman, a shrimper. And it seems like oystering, although it has its own challenges, seems to have a more of an opportunity or a brighter future associated with it.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Mike Latta. He's head chef and owner of Fig and the Ordinary in Charleston, and Brian Rackley is co-owner of the Kimball House in Atlanta. Brian, he's talking about grabbing a boat. Mike's talking about grabbing a boat and going out and capture wild oysters. University of Georgia is not necessarily recommending people do that. Why?
Well, honestly, it's my opinion from an ecological standpoint that those oysters are best for the most part, left alone. They have a very...
Is it because they're filtering? Because one oyster can filter 50 gallons of water every day.
Well, it's because they're filtering, but they're also generating a lot of biodiversity. So, I mean, it's not that you can't cull some of these and still have your roasting culture, but if you're looking to raise millions and millions of oysters to send into markets across the Southeast and perhaps nationally, I think you have to think about ways that you can produce oysters on a more consistent and more reliable scale. So that's why I think farming is the way to do that. And you can still sort of make a contribution ecologically in terms of, you know, biodiversity or, you know, and filtration, just to improve the quality of water where you have oysters living and filtering.
Yeah,
but
they're kind of amazing
creatures. Yeah, in my own little sort of humble opinion, I would suggest, you know, stick to the farming and leave the wild stuff alone as much as you can. I mean, they're there for, they're doing a lot of good work out there. So, you know, let them do their job is kind of the way I feel about it.
Did you grow up liking oysters, or is that something you had to learn to like?
No, I did. I remember the one that I ate the first time.
Was it raw?
Yeah, it was raw. And my dad says that I was eating them a little bit earlier than that. The first one I remember eating was 5. And, you know, I mean, who's to say? It could have been that I really, really loved eating oysters. I mean, it was on a cracker and covered in cocktail sauce. So, yeah, it tastes like cracker and cocktail sauce at that point.
Right.
But yeah, I think it was just kind of an act of solidarity. My brother and my dad and I ate them, and my mom didn't.
So it was a guy thing.
It was kind of a guy thing.
What about you, Mike? Did you grow up liking them?
No, actually, I didn't really like any seafood until I decided to become a professional chef and, you know, had been working on Martha's Vineyard and knew that I would have to develop an appreciation for it if I wanted to be taken seriously as a chef. So I kind of just started, you know, putting my toe in the water and eating everything I could until I finally developed a taste for it. And after I set up shop here in Charleston, it came to my attention that really this is the only really wild and or distinctly Charleston thing that we do here is the seafood that we have. And then from the shellfish to the finfish, maybe the greatest expression of what the food in Charleston is like, and really kind of just started developing a further appreciation for it as I grew older. And then, you know, I had an aha moment about oysters maybe about 7 or 8 years ago where, you know, standing on a boat in the water, eating them directly off the beds, you know, just one or two, and saying, this is what oysters from Charleston taste like. And I love that. And I love the way they taste. And this is what I associate now with my town. And I felt, you know, proud of the product. And it became a point of pride.
And then you have now had them, Mike, fried, also steamed. Do oysters usually stand on their own? Or are they the kind of ingredient that you can put into other things?
Oh, they're incredibly versatile. I mean, you can do all kinds of stuff with them. Obviously, you can fry them. Steaming them is something that we've done here in Charleston for a long time. But as far as like using them as a base for sauces or, you know, any kind of, you know, just like, you know, for gumbo, soup, stew, pies. They're in woven thickly in the culture here in Charleston.
Now, I was asking my neighbor, who really likes oysters, Brian, about how the best way to eat oysters is. She said raw. But when I mentioned steaming, she made the biggest face you've ever seen. And I thought to myself, well, what's the difference between steaming a clam and steaming an oyster? Why do we think differently about oysters than some of the other shellfish that we eat?
I don't know. That's a great question. And I think historically people have just eaten oysters raw.
Yeah.
You know, there's a myriad of reasons why people ate oysters raw and
but not,
cook,
I mean,
cook,
most
cook
people
their clams.
Don't open up a clam and guzzle it.
No, they don't. And I don't know why. It may just be because naturally, I mean, have you eaten a raw clam recently?
I've never eaten a raw clam.
I like raw clams just fine, but they can be pretty metallic. So, you know, with the exception of, like, Mike was mentioning the bologna earlier, you know, that's a pretty metallic oyster. But I think that oysters are generally a lot more accessible to eat raw than clams are in terms of just, like, people's natural tastes. A raw oyster to me is just preferable to a raw clam.
Mike, we're almost out of time, but I wonder why is it that most of the oysters Americans eat come from the Atlantic? I mean, the oysters live all over the place. Why does our particular coast, why does our side of the country supply most of our oysters?
Well, I think that we've got, I mean, I think the sheer volume of oysters that are produced here is a good reason why. And there's been a culture of harvesting and selling these oysters all over the place for a very long time. And I just don't know if they're as plentiful on the West Coast. We personally don't buy a lot of oysters on the West Coast. But it seems like for me, it's just the sheer quantity that's available.
So we have about a minute left, Brian. And, you know, in 2014, Virginia did really well. They sold, I think, like $17 million worth of oysters. Mm-hmm. Is there a saturation point?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be a saturation point at some given time. But, you know, for us, I think it's important for us to kind of embrace what's happening here in the South. You know, there's a lot of people that are doing good work and they're growing really good stuff. And, you know, ultimately it makes the South a better place to eat and a more interesting place to live when we have these types of industry.
And I assume both of you would say if you haven't tried an oyster yet, then you should try one.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Brian Rackley is a co-owner of the Kimball House in Atlanta. Mike Latta is head chef and owner of Fig and the Ordinary in Charleston. Mike will teach a class on the best ways to prepare an oyster this Saturday afternoon. That's at the Southern Grown Festival on Sea Island. Brian and Mike, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Southern Grown Festival kicks off this Thursday. It runs through the weekend. You can get more information about Mike's class and the festival at gpbnews.org. That's our show for today. But before we go, tell us if you love oysters or hate them, because honestly, it seems like it's either one or the other with most people. Are you an oyster fan? And if so, what is the best way to eat them? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.